The Coptic Magical Papyri Podcast.
Dear listeners, welcome to our fifth podcast. As you know, we have been doing this series of interviews with the Coptic Magical Papyri Project, that is with Gorshi Dosso, Edward Love, and myself, Marketa Preininger. Edward will be talking to us about the development of the Egyptian language, and this podcast will technically have two parts, because the development of the Egyptian language is very complex. Edward, in the first part, will be talking about Egyptian language in general and a little bit about himself, of course. And in the second part, he will focus mostly on Coptic. So today comes the first part. And who exactly is Edward O.D. Love? Following the completion of a BA and MSD in Oriental Studies in Egyptology with a focus in Demotic and Coptic at the University of Oxford, Edward undertook two research years at the Egyptological Institute of the University of Heidelberg under the supervision of Joachim Kwak. And he was focusing again on Demotic as well as Old Coptic and textual culture. The first of these research years saw the completion of a monograph on the bilingual Old Coptic and Greek spells of PGM4, entitled Code Switching with the Gods, while the second founded a comprehensive study of the sources exhibiting the use of so-called Old Coptic scripts. In 2016, Edward Love returned to the University of Oxford as a PhD student in Oriental Studies, and he was supervised by Mark Smith, and he completed the PhD research in 2019 following the examination of a thesis entitled Innovative Scripts and Spellings in Roman Egypt, Investigations into Script Conventions, Domains, Shift and Obsolescence as evidenced by Hieroglyphic, Hieratic, Demotic and Old Coptic Manuscripts. From September 2018, he has been a contributing postdoctoral researcher to the project The Coptic Magical Papyri. This year, he is beginning a habilitation thesis on the tradition of petitioning deities in late and Greco-Roman period Egypt, as evidenced by the so-called Demotic letters to the gods and Greek prayers for justice. So as you can see, Edward is really an expert on the Egyptian language, especially in the Roman period. In today's podcast, I sat down with Ed to talk a lot also about his Oxford years. So if you're interested in the history of the Griffiths Institute, Edward also talks about that. And later on in the podcast, he goes on more deeply into the aspects of the Egyptian language. So thank you very much for listening, as always, and I really hope that you enjoy today's podcast. Hi Ed, let's talk a bit about your background first before jumping more into the linguistic questions. What raised your interest in Coptic and Demotic?
Hi Marketa, thanks. I'm very glad to start at the beginning because I think to explain how it is I'm so interested in doing what I'm doing, it makes sense to go back to that beginning and explain how I got there in the first place. So I did an undergraduate degree, a BA, in Oriental Studies, as it's still called, at the University of Oxford. And my specific focus as part of that degree was in Egyptology. In my first year, I did a mix of Egyptology and Near Eastern Studies. But the language component of that degree was always focused on forms of the Egyptian language and the scripts that we used to write the Egyptian language. In my second year, I had the opportunity to choose a second subject, and that could be anything from archaeology, anthropology, all the way through to ancient and modern languages. And I chose Coptic at that time. So in my third year, I was able to take Demotic as part of that three-year program, as well as, at that time, Greco-Roman hieroglyphs. So by the end of my undergraduate degree, I'd had at least a very substantial introduction, but the combination Demotic and Coptic, which remains my principal focus until today, came about because I was encouraged by Liz Frood, who is assistant professor of Egyptology in Oxford and still today, to investigate options for my BA thesis. She encouraged me to do something that would draw upon my specific interest in Coptic and later forms of the Egyptian language. To that effect, when I was an undergraduate student, I undertook a lot of volunteer work in the archive of the Griffith Institute. So the Griffith Institute is the department for Egyptology, Assyriology, Near Eastern Studies in Oxford, and it was founded after the death of Francis Griffith, who was the first professor of Egyptology in Oxford. And it was actually founded thanks to the combined wealth of his first wife, Kate Bradbury, and his second wife, Nora MacDonald. And after his death, Nora MacDonald Griffith ensured not only that Francis Griffith's, as I say, combined wealth, thanks to his family and the families he married into, but also his library and store of research materials were donated to the university to form the bedrock of what was then to become the Griffith Institute. And I'm not sure exactly how this came to be, but presumably this became a tradition from the point of departure of the department, where it obviously took a lot of the material that was left over, Griffith's research notes, not just books, but all of his notes and sketches and all these kinds of things. It became a place where huge stores of archival material related to the history of Egyptology were deposited. So not only does the archive of the Griffith Institute have the material that was donated by the Griffith family, it also has a host of other archive material. For example, Howard Carter's notebooks and sketches, not just from the tomb of Tutankhamun, but also, you know, vast parts of his career in Egypt. We have the Burton photographs, which were taken, the black and white photographs, incredibly famous, of course, of Tutankhamun's tomb. Then we have the materials from other academics associated with Oxford throughout the decades, Alan Gardner and Yaroslav Cherny. And in particular, I was interested in the material of Walter Ewing Crum, who will be known to people who are familiar with Coptic or Coptic studies as quite literally the writer of the dictionary, the principal dictionary, a Coptic dictionary, as it's called, that was published by Crum and was really his life's work. And not only do we have the original index slips, every single piece of paper that Crum used to write down every single Coptic word he discovered and all the important attestations of that word in countless Coptic texts. That's 250,000 of those slips, more or less, in total. We have, of course, a huge archive holding which has Crum's notebooks. And so, coming back to Liz Frood, she suggested that maybe I should go and see among Crum's papers what might be discoverable topic for an undergraduate thesis. And that was very serendipitous in hindsight because, as I say, having worked in the archive and especially volunteering to help get a better understanding of the vast quantity of material in that archive, I worked closely with Catherine Worsey, who has spent years and years and years in the archive understanding exactly what there is among all of these papers. And she helped me look through, or she directed me as I looked through some of the notebooks and collections of archive holdings to do with Crum, as I was looking for Coptic topics, for example, unpublished texts, texts that perhaps have been lost in the war, notes on texts that Crum never finished working on, all these kinds of things. And we came to a small collection of envelopes, which were mostly unmarked. And what was very interesting is that they were not really described in the catalogue of the Griffith Institute archive. The Crum catalogue is very substantial now and has been developed in the last years and can be found online, the Griffith Institute archives, the Griffith Institute's website. But we didn't know exactly what was in them. And we opened one envelope to find some pieces of papyri, great interest. We opened another little box to find an ostracon. And we opened another housing, so a piece of paper, essentially, light cardboard that's used to contain a piece of archive material, and found a newspaper from the 1900s. And this newspaper had written on it, sent to Crum from Petrie in the 1900s. And opening this folded piece of paper, this newspaper itself, of course, being at that time more than 100 years old, we found inside two folded pieces of parchment, which were then, of course, much, much older. They had been folded, of course, for around, if not over, 1,000 years. And so one doesn't simply prize open a piece of folded parchment, but we had a little peek before it was professionally relaxed by colleagues at the Ashmolean Museum Conservation Department and saw these extraordinary drawings on the inside of this parchment. There was nothing on the outside of the parchment we could see except ink seepage from what would have been the front side of the parchment that was then folded in on itself. And inside I saw Coptic characters, or what I recognized instantly as Coptic letters. And we also saw some figures, some drawings. And as I say, once we came back to those, we realized that these figures were part of this extraordinary corpus that we have in the Coptic magical tradition. Drawings, images of angels, of demons, of the cherubim that were used in the Coptic magical tradition, both in healing prescriptions and producing amulets, and also in curses. The two images were quite extraordinary, and hopefully these will be published very soon in a volume that coincidentally is being edited by Corsi Dorsu. And they became known affectionately, the first of the two parchments, as Crumb's chicken, because of the very extraordinary resemblance that one of these figures had to a kind of chicken-headed cartoon that was familiar to me from the, at least from my perspective, from the film Chicken Run. And the other one was a kind of camel-like demon, it seemed. It was a multi-legged sort of mammalian zoomorph with a couple of humps, and it was being bound or held by an anthropomorphic figure that was labelled Apapaula, so Apapaulos. The publication of these two parchments goes into a discussion of exactly what these figures represented, what their associations were, and what these parchments essentially were produced for, what particular ritual practices they were intended to bring about in their desired aims and thereby their principal outcomes. The peculiar end to the story is that no sooner had we, as I say, peeked inside these very creased folded pieces of parchment, that the heavens opened and the rain came down. Now, the Griffith Institute is inside, is built inside, or is part of the Sackler Library in Oxford. And the Sackler Library has a lower ground floor where the archive of the Griffith Institute is held. So when you're in the archive, you can look out into an atrium, which is essentially between the entrance to the library and the archive. And this atrium is lower than ground level. So when the heavens open and the rain comes down very hard, as it often does in Oxford, this atrium begins to collect a lot of water, make quite a sound. And as I say, when the rain comes down very hard, doesn't seem to be draining as quickly as it's coming down. And then, of course, the thunder came as well. And it was indeed quite a spooky experience to be standing there looking at these parchments that, as I say, had perhaps gone unnoticed for more than 100 years since Petrie sent them from Cairo to Crumb, and perhaps had really gone unread since they were produced perhaps 1,000 or more years before. As I suggest in the publication of these parchments, the parallels to the figures that are depicted on them, the demon-like chicken figure, the demon camel figure, and Apapaula, that's Apapaulos, seem to relate to malign magical practices, so to curse texts. So that association, as I say, even in hindsight here, is even spookier when we think about looking at these for the first time in centuries or in a millennium, and the heavens opening, the thunder clapping, and the rain coming down. And from that day, I suppose, I was absolutely fascinated by this kind of material. And not only did we find those two particular figural amulets, the amulets that are principally comprised of figural, so drawn image elements rather than textual elements, we found a fragment of a parchment of prayers and magical texts that was quite late, that was in Coptic and in Greek, which I edited for my undergraduate thesis. So I did, after all, find something, as Liz Froude suggested that I might, that I could work on for my undergraduate thesis. And from that point, I couldn't stop really working on magical material. Demotic then came as, I suppose, a natural progression, when I started my MST in Oxford, so Master of Studies. It's a kind of one-year introduction to research methods, and further skills building saw me read Coptic and Demotic texts with Mark Smith there, building on the Coptic introduction that I'd had by Geza Schenker in my undergraduate years. And those combined opportunities enabled me not only to get to know the corpus of Coptic magical texts, but also those in Demotic. And that essentially saw me then move on to one of my other principal interests that kind of straddles these two corpora, the so-called Old Coptic texts, which I think we're going to come to later.
You spent many years in Oxford before coming to Heidelberg and Würzburg. How has this transfer been academically and personally? Are the academic environments in the UK and in Germany very different?
Yeah, that's a really important question. Thanks, Marketa, for asking it. I think the decision in hindsight to have a chance to experience different university systems was really crucial for not only my academic development, but also personal development. Yes, I think after spending 4 years in Oxford, to some people, leaving and going elsewhere seemed like quite an interesting decision to make. I looked to going abroad not only because I needed to really develop my foreign language skills. I was studying with colleagues in Oxford who already had several foreign languages under their belt. Indeed, they were perhaps not studying in their native language by studying in English. And due to having had very little opportunity to study foreign languages at school and no opportunity to study German, I wanted to be able to catch up, essentially, that huge gap in my knowledge and ability by going abroad. And specifically, I started to look for opportunities in Germany. The happy coincidence was that my interests in Coptic and Demotic magical texts overlapped with the interests of a research group led by Joachim Kruck in Heidelberg on the Demotic corpus, the corpus in Demotic of magical texts. And so having won a stipend from the DRRD, which encourages German students to go abroad and for students who are not from Germany to go and study in Germany, fantastic institution, I was able to go there for a year as a short-term student and have an opportunity to experience that system as well as develop my own interest in Demotic, Coptic, and specifically, as we say, those magical texts. Personally, first and foremost, as a transfer, it, as I say, was such a formative experience by nature of the fact that, as with going to university in the first place, I was incredibly naive about what it would entail. I didn't really have any idea. I felt that I was prepared, but of course, once you're in it, suddenly you realise that your preparations perhaps weren't as sufficient as you thought they were in the first place. So that was a huge learning curve and a very important one. Not least, of course, as I say, for someone growing up in a monolingual environment with very little exposure to foreign languages. Indeed, I don't think I know anyone from my home environment who speaks another language. So that kind of exposure was never there, but also someone obviously who himself doesn't speak a foreign language, to then live in a foreign language environment was a great challenge and one that has informed a lot of my further research interests in bilingualism and different script forms, different language stages and all those kind of aspects, because I suppose it was so absent in my own early life. And then the academic progression and change was also quite dramatic. The university systems in the UK and in Germany are really quite different. In Germany, you have the semester system, which enables you to choose different courses each semester, which will award you points if you pass them, which you can build up into a portfolio of points. That then means that when you've met the particular threshold, you have achieved your degree, whereas in the UK, usually you have very set or more or less set syllabuses, which are then the structure by which you study. So while I mentioned that I had an option to choose a second subject in Oxford, the progression of subjects that you study, for example, in Egyptology was more or less set. So Middle Egyptian and then Late Egyptian and Old Egyptian. And if you choose on top of that, you can do Coptic and Demotic and Greco-Roman hieroglyphs in Oxford. But in the German environment, depending on which courses are being offered at which time, you can take all manner of different combinations of things. You can, of course, go away for exchanges and come back, put your studies on hold if you need to. And there's obviously a substantial sort of infrastructure behind that, which means that the German university system has those opportunities, where in the UK it's more set for a 3-year or 4-year degree. And the academic environments, I suppose, are also quite different. But that's principally because of the kind of research that is done, I think, in these different departments. So if you consider, you know, what is termed the Anglo-Saxon world, so the English-speaking academic world, the kind of work that's produced in that environment is often very thematic and addresses particular research questions and is focused principally towards, as I say, answering those particular kinds of questions. The German academic environment is, in a way, one of the powerhouses still of the bread and butter work that Egyptologists do, which is to excavate new material and thereby primary source evidence for understanding ancient Egypt, and the philological work of editing these discovered and thus far unknown sources for textual culture that come from Egypt and thereby serve as primary sources for all manner of questions and topics and things. That's not to say that there aren't people, of course there are archaeologists in the Anglo-Saxon world, and of course there are academics in the German-speaking world to undertake these research question-based thematic topics. But it's much more common, say, for a student in Germany to have a research topic that is the edition of a lot of texts or the study of a corpus of material culture, whereas, to say, in the Anglo-Saxon world, it seems more to be a question of let's answer this particular research inquiry, or let's at least address this particular thematic aspect of ancient Egyptian history and such things. That's at least my impression from the two environments of the principal differences. And that means, of course, that when you move between these two different environments, you get to know colleagues who are specialists in quite distinct things. Funny things about Egyptology is when you tell people that that's what you study or that's what you do now, if you're fortunate enough to do it as a career, as we are, that they say, oh, that sounds like a very niche thing to do, or that sounds like a very specific focused discipline. And as I say, the funny thing about Egyptology is that even though it focuses on one particular cultural environment in roughly the geographical bounds of modern Egypt, it's a hugely diverse discipline. I mean, Egyptology is really a form of area studies, and there are a complement of disciplines that come within that particular type of area studies. So you could be an archaeologist or an anthropologist, you could be a linguist, you could be a philologist, you could be all many manner of different things, you could be someone who's interested in the history of economics, you could be a religious historian. All of these factors, disciplines, approaches are part of what it means to do Egyptology, if indeed it means something to do Egyptology. And so moving between these academic environments allows you to see a wider spectrum of different colleagues and specialists who are able to, as I say, approach questions of Egyptian history or sources preserved from ancient Egypt in completely different ways to other colleagues. And that's really the multiplicity and the diversity of Egyptology, which doesn't necessarily come across under the title Egyptology, as it indeed sounds like the specific focus of one particular culture and one particular approach, which I don't think it ever has been. And now that multidisciplinary approaches are really seen to be the baseline that disciplines should be aiming for, Egyptology is coming to the fore, in that by nature of it being actually a very diverse discipline in the first place.
When I explain to my friends and family what I'm doing, they don't really understand what the various stages of the Egyptian language are and what is really the difference between Coptic and Demotic and how does this relate to the hieroglyphs, etc. I hope that you can answer some of these questions today. So the evolution of the Egyptian language is quite puzzling, as I've said. Can you explain the different stages and the relationships between the scripts, and can you give some temporal and geographical boundaries for their use?
Sure, I'm very happy to give it a go. It is indeed a very puzzling map, a map that isn't just, as you say, geographical, but also temporal when we look at it. And I suppose the place to start is to say that the Egyptian language, unfortunately, died out in its contemporary colloquial use, as in its use as a living language spoken by communities of people in, well, from the European perspective, we call the Middle Ages. Exactly when is disputed and also hard to assess now, but it is dead language. Like Latin, it is now used in the Coptic Church. The Egyptian Coptic language, more fully described, survives in a liturgical form, but is still used in the Coptic Church, as Latin is used in the Catholic Church. But unfortunately, we don't have witnesses to it as a spoken language nowadays. We don't have any related languages that are either directly or indirectly descended from Egyptian surviving. And so establishing even very basic aspects of understanding of the Egyptian language is hard to begin with. In comparison, our colleagues in Near Eastern Studies, Assyriology, who study ancient Mesopotamia and the writing systems and languages spoken there, have modern day Semitic languages that they can relate to these earlier forms. So modern Arabic and Hebrew, for example, as Semitic languages, are related to older Sumerian and Akkadian, insofar as they all belong to a wider Semitic family of languages. Unfortunately, we don't have that for Egyptian. So that's one big stumbling block at the very beginning of the study of the Egyptian language that has, of course, lots of consequences for our understanding of the language. So before I say anything about the forms of the Egyptian language and the scripts that were used to write the Egyptian language, one thing that's an important distinction with our modern context of writing is that ancient Egypt and into the Greco-Roman period was a scribal culture. And that means that just as today there are specialists you go to when you need your dishwasher fixed or you need your car fixed, electricians, plumbers, mechanics, you name it, all these specialist disciplines that people have as careers. In ancient Egypt, one of those specialist disciplines, careers, was writing. And there were, of course, many different forms of writing, but there was no general literacy in ancient Egypt, which means that there were certain types of people whose job it was to learn how to write in order to produce particular types of textual culture. And if you were a, let's just for sake of argument, call them a secular scribe, someone who worked in the administration, you would learn how to write documents such as contracts or receipts or letters. If you wanted to write a letter to somebody, you would go to a scribe who would be able to write a letter for you, send it to somebody, and then at the other end, someone who could read would read it to the recipient, for example. So these very important distinctions are really quite dramatic when it comes to studying the forms of Egyptian writing that we have and the way we should understand how that writing was produced and by whom it was produced. Similarly, if you were going to look at a ritual text, for example, very famous Book of the Dead or the pyramid texts, this is a kind of writing that would have been undertaken by priestly scribes, so individuals who were both trained to serve in a priesthood but also would have been trained in particular types of writing, which would have enabled them to read and write those particular types of texts. And we shouldn't assume too much overlap in this scribal culture. So really, there were many scribal cultures. We shouldn't assume that someone who was trained to read and write administrative texts, but we shouldn't assume too much overlap between these different areas of writing. We should really think of different scribal cultures. So you had scribes who were trained to write different types of documents for the administration. We shouldn't assume that they were actually able to read and write these other types of textual culture, such as the Book of the Dead and ritual texts, because that was the result of a particular type of training that those particular scribes would have got as part of being in a priesthood. Of course, there was overlap, and it's a very simplistic, broad brushstrokes description, but we need to, from the outset, bear in mind that we're talking about a form of writing that was the product of a particular elite, for want of a better word, that was specifically trained to write these forms of Egyptian and to which the vast majority of the population had no access at any point in Egyptian history. But then we also need to, from that point, say that the Egyptian language is very, very old. Of course, lots of languages are very, very old, but we kind of have an idea of how old it is insofar as it's among the earliest written languages. So for the vast majority of languages that have ever been spoken, they have no written form and have emerged and changed and disappeared or changed so much they've morphed into something else. And we don't have traces of that because we don't have a written form. But Egypt is famous for pyramids and hieroglyphs and mummies, at least from my perspective. And of course, the hieroglyphs element of that is crucial for the long-term attestation of the Egyptian language and writing that we have. The fact that we have these monuments dating back into the Old Kingdom that are built of limestone, substantial architectural constructions that have survived for not just centuries but millennia, means that we're able to read forms of the Egyptian language that are very, 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 very old indeed. So even though the Egyptian language has died out as a spoken language and as a written language in the form of Coptic, wasn't used in a productive, only a reproductive way until the modern times with neo-speakers of Coptic and neo-writers of Coptic who've tried to reintroduce the language, we have a huge written history of Egyptian. It's really quite mind-boggling. If we go back to the earliest attestations of hieroglyphic writing, the estimates, the deductions, the hypotheses vary, but a consensus has kind of fallen around the end of the 4th millennium BCE, the 32nd or the 31st century BCE. So we're talking more than 5,000 years ago. We have tags and sealings and things which look like the precursors of hieroglyphic writing. So that's an extraordinarily vast temporal frame to begin with. If we arbitrarily cut off Coptic in, let's say the Middle Ages, 1500 CE, we rewind that back to these earliest attestations of hieroglyphic writing, we're looking at 4,500 years, which is, say, mind-boggling. Although the earliest forms of Egyptian writing in with substantial amounts of grammar, you know, readable texts aren't that old, we still have this long, long history. But the next important distinction is, say, not just between the form of the Egyptian language that changed, but also the scripts. Now, the distinction between a written and a spoken language is really important because, for example, there's a written form of English that has its established versions. So in Britain, we have a specific type of spelling that we use. In America, they have a distinctive type of spelling that is becoming the international standard. And of course, any English speaker can, if they have the opportunity, learn to read that one of those particular standard systems, but they'll pronounce it in their own way, and they might write their own forms of the language in a way that reflects more their spoken variety of language. When we're looking at Egyptian writing, we need to remember that concurrent to all forms of Egyptian writing, there was a spoken form of Egyptian that, to a lesser or greater extent, would have been similar or very different to the written form of the language. And some linguists dedicate their entire careers to identifying aspects in these kinds of texts that help us understand changes to the spoken language or how different or close to the spoken language the written language was, and enable us to, as I say, fill in some of those gaps that we don't have because the Egyptian language is unfortunately a dead language. But as a concurrent stream of language, we don't really have a direct witness to the spoken Egyptian language throughout this time, which makes sense, of course. If we only had written forms of English and the English language died out, or let's fast forward 1,000 years, the English language has died out for some reason, and we only have written forms of English, and we have no audio files with recorded English and no video files, etc., it would be very, very hard for us to say how close to or different from the spoken language written English was. And then another distinction that we need to make, unfortunately, is between the forms of the written language, so the grammar and everything that governed the rules of the language, and the scripts that the language was written in. So as I say, going back to the very end of the 4th millennium BCE, we have these early tags and sealings from funerary deposits, which are suggestive of the early stages of the development of hieroglyphic writing. But we also have other scripts that are used for writing the Egyptian language. So around the turn of the 3rd millennium BCE, so the 13th century onwards, so about 5,000 years ago, is the proposed sort of turning point, the beginning, the establishment of the dynastic history of Egypt as we see it, for the emergence of hieratic. And while hieroglyphs, as I said, were carved in architectural forms ultimately through most of their history, we also have forms of the written language that were written not on in stone with a chisel and a mace, but with ink on particular types of media, so particular types of writing surface. And while hieroglyphs, as I say, in tags and ceilings were suited to this more iconographic form, we have a form of writing known as hieratic, which was used from its earliest history as it developed out of cursive forms of hieroglyphs that were written principally with a pen and ink on different types of surfaces. So if you wanted to write a receipt, for example, or you wanted to write even a more substantial text and you didn't want to have to draw all of the individual hieroglyphic signs in exquisite detail, you had the opportunity to utilize a pen and ink and form a more cursive and ligatured form of the script that derived ultimately from those hieroglyphs for writing those kinds of texts. This quicker to write form of the hieroglyphic script, which developed out of a cursive form of hieroglyphs, as I say, is known as hieratic and was used, as we know now from earlier witnesses, from the Old Kingdom all the way through to the late 2nd century or even early 3rd century CE. And then we have a form of hieratic in the same way that hieratic developed from cursive hieroglyphs and developed over that 3,000 years of history quite substantially, but also not so much that different stages aren't recognizable, at least to Egyptologists. We have another cursive form of writing called demotic, this script which developed essentially out of hieratic, but centuries and centuries later. The difference in time between the emergence of hieratic in the Old Kingdom and the emergence of demotic in the late period is about 2,000 years. So we're talking about a huge period of time in which the hieratic script, of course, changed and changed and changed over generations and centuries. Now, the interesting thing about the late period is that it emerged following a period of decentralization of power in Egypt, known conventionally as the Third Intermediate Period. And at that time, you didn't have one king in his court who was in charge of all of Egypt, and not just in charge of all of Egypt in terms of administration, but also in terms of writing system, for example. Now, a very brief tangent is to say that the written form of English, that is the standard variety in Britain, is based on the southeastern dialect of English, historically speaking. Now, why? Because the capital of England and subsequently Britain was London, which is that southeastern region. That was the seat of power. And so that is why the type of English writing that we use reflects more closely that regional language variety than any other. Now, if we go back to Egypt, when you had a king in his court, that was where the center of power was, not just administration, but also in terms of the standard, the law, and in this particular case, the writing system. And if you didn't have one king in his court sending out the paradigms, as it were, the exemplars of writing to all different parts of Egypt, you had these regionalizations of writing. Now, again, another brief tangent is to say when America gained its independence and separated from, in terms of administration, governance, law, etc., from Britain, this spelling reform and these changes reflected regional changes to the language there, which were then, as I say, reflected in the spelling, the way in which the language was written, which is still distinct until today. Now, jumping back to this intermediate period, in the north of Egypt, you had one center of power, and in the south of Egypt, you had another center of power. We'll come on to later how they had different forms of spoken Egyptian, but because there was no particular center of unified power in Egypt, there were several centuries in which the writing systems, so the forms of hieratic, could diverge from one another, because they simply developed differently in the north, in Lower Egypt, to in the south, in Upper Egypt. And we have a development in Upper Egypt in the south of hieratic into what's known as abnormal, or perhaps better, cursive hieratic, in the third intermediate period. And in the north, we have a development of hieratic into what becomes essentially demotic. And why did demotic become the principal script of essentially secular writing in Egypt after the late period. Well, it's because it was the seat of power in the north, in Lower Egypt, which came to quote unquote reunify Egypt during the late period. And then it imposed, particularly in the reign of Amasis II in the 6th century BCE, imposed Demotic throughout Egypt, sending out from its centralized base of power these paradise, these exemplars, and demonstrating that under this particular rulership, Demotic will be the written standard for those non-secular writings. And so we have a replacement, essentially, of this abnormal or cursive hieratic in the south by Demotic in the north as a result of these political changes that are occurring, which, as I say, kind of relate to these brief historical tangents with Britain and America. So that's the Demotic scripts and its introduction. But all of the scripts of Egyptian writing, of the Egyptian writing system, were attested up until the end of the early Roman period, or in some cases, even the late Roman period. So what do I mean by that? There were different domains of Egyptian writing. Hieroglyphs were principally the script you'd use if you were going to carve a text on a temple wall, inside a pyramid, on a tomb wall, on a stela, in a monumental context that was supposed to, and indeed did last centuries and millennia. Hieratic, as I mentioned, this more cursive form of the script was much more easily written than hieroglyphs with a pen and with ink on different types of media, different types of surface of writing. So papyri, of course, ostraca, so potsherds made of ceramics or limestone, wooden tablets covered in gypsum, which you could wash clean, for example. And that was also very much true for Demotic because it became this secular replacement for hieratic. It's a difficult thing to get our head around nowadays because we, as at least in this context, you and I as English speakers and English writers, we have one script and one standardized form of the written language. That's not the case in Egyptian history, and it has a lot to do with the vast periods of time that we're dealing with and this history of centralization. So just a brief word on the stages of the language, so-called. The relationship between the stages I'm about to describe is not really diachronic. It's not really a direct relationship. One developed into the next, developed into the next. We only have these textual witnesses. We only know what we know about the changes in the spoken language by nature of these isolated examples of texts throughout all of Egyptian history. What's conventionally termed Old Egyptian was the Egyptian that was written in the Old Kingdom, which kind of makes sense. The earliest witness of a real sentence in Egyptian is from the 27th century BCE, and the earliest substantial secular texts are from the 4th and into the 5th dynasty. So that's about 4,600 years ago, and it's about 4,300 years ago in the 5th and the 6th dynasties that the very famous pyramid texts appear. And this form of Egyptian, which has a particular type of syntax and grammar, relates to, but is not a direct predecessor of, Middle Egyptian, which seems to be a regional language variety from a different part of Egypt. Now, in the Old Kingdom, the seat of power was in Memphis, and in the Middle Kingdom, that was not the case. So Middle Egyptian that appears from the 11th dynasty onwards, so during the Middle Kingdom period, is slightly different. So that's 4,000 years ago, up until essentially the early New Kingdom. And Old and Middle Egyptian form a relationship which is known as Egyptian 1 or First Phase Egyptian. They have a more synthetic grammar. The grammar of the language is based more on inflection. So the way that the forms of the words change to designate their roles. And Late Egyptian, or New Egyptian as it's called in the German-speaking world of Egyptology, appears essentially during the reign of Akhenaten. And Late or New Egyptian is the beginning of a period of language development which is conventionally termed Egyptian 2 or Second Phase Egyptian, where the grammar has actually changed quite so much from Old and Middle Egyptian that it's more analytic. So we essentially have fewer inflections and more helper words and forms and morphemes. So the grammar has many more particles and prepositions, and word order is more fixed than before. And so that's one of the, you know, principal grammatic changes that we don't need to really concern ourselves with. But that's quite a turning point, because from essentially the reign of Akhenaten in the 18th dynasty, we have a written form of Late Egyptian alongside an archaizing form of Middle Egyptian that is still written up until the end of Egyptian history. Now let's just try and get our heads around that again. So there was a written form of late Egyptian, which was contemporary in the New Kingdom. So that was, as I say, roughly 3,300, 3,400 years ago. And that was written for another, well, more than 1,500 years, up until about 1,800 years ago. So into the second and third centuries CE of the Common Era. How is that even possible? Well, this relates to the question of domains of writing, which I will come back to. We then have an emergence of another form of the Egyptian language, which is known as Demotic, which is confusing because this stage of the language is therefore called the same as the script, which, to say, causes confusion, but ultimately it's just a convenient term for the form of Egyptian language that was written principally in the Demotic script, but not exclusively. Now, Demotic, as I say, as a script emerged in the late period, principally, and we have a form of the language that's quite different from late Egyptian by nature of the fact that it's 600 to 700 years younger, as in it comes in 600 to 700 years later than late Egyptian or New Egyptian. But also, this is a form of the written language that persists contemporary with late Egyptian and Middle Egyptian up until the Roman period. So now we come to domains of writing. If you want to write something on a permanent surface, the principal form of writing throughout Egyptian history is going to be hieroglyphs. And back into the Old Kingdom, a large proportion of texts were written in hieroglyphs or cursive forms of hieroglyphs than in later periods of history. So although hieroglyphs and a cursive form of hieroglyphs were used even in the Old Kingdom for most forms of writing that existed then, there were many more domains of writing that appeared throughout Egyptian history, especially in the late Old Kingdom. What do I mean by a domain of writing? Essentially, if we think about modern English, there are different ways to write English in different contexts. There's the very formalized standard of academic writing, where you have to spell things in a certain way, and there are grammatical aspects of the language that, for example, are dying out in the spoken language. So in academic writing, you might want to say with whom, and in spoken English, at least in my experience among native speakers in Britain, those kinds of expressions are dying out. And so you only find them in this particular form of writing that's used in particular domains. Another domain of English writing might be Twitter. It could be the very complex forms of legalistic English that's written, all these kinds of things. The kind of English we use in writing in different contexts is vastly different from one another, even though the variations aren't language stages and scripts like they were in ancient Egypt. So if we think about the ancient Egyptian context, we have forms of writing that appear in monumental contexts, on tomb walls, temple walls, all these kinds of permanent media, essentially. And that was principally hieroglyphs throughout its history. And the cursive form thereof that developed into hieratic in the Old Kingdom was used throughout Egyptian history for in different domains. And from the Old Kingdom, it was used essentially in all domains of writing. So let's think about ritual texts. It was used there. Documentary texts, it was used there. Judicial legal texts, it was used there. What else do we have? All kinds of documentary sources, technical texts like medical treatises, all these kinds of things. And for a lot of Egyptian history, that was the case. We have hieroglyphs in particular contexts and hieratic in others. The forms of the Egyptian language that were written in hieratic and hieroglyphs differed, however, as time went on. So in the Old Kingdom, the grammar of the language was principally that which we call Old Egyptian. And then in the Middle Kingdom, there were still aspects of Old Egyptian there, but it really is this Middle Egyptian. But then from the New Kingdom, this introduction of a really different type of grammar, this second phase Egyptian, as opposed to the first phase Egyptian of Old and Middle Egyptian, means that there's a bit of a divergence in the types of Egyptian written. So while you had a domain of writing, say, ritual texts written in hieratic that maintained an older form of Middle Egyptian in its grammar, you also had contemporary with that in the New Kingdom, hieratic as a script, writing late Egyptian, so quite a distinct form of grammar in domains of writing such as documentary texts, so contracts and receipts and journals, these kinds of things. So when the spoken language has changed and the written language eventually catches up with those changes, but there's still a desire to preserve an older form of a particular written language, you get these divergences, which are sometimes called, for example, a diglossia. So in other languages, such as, say, German or even Arabic, you have a formal written and spoken standard. So in German, that's High German. Arabic is a nice example because there's a modern standard of Arabic that is used in a lot of contemporary forms and domains of writing. But there's also a classical form of Arabic that is that of the Quran and other forms of textual culture. So there we see quite a distinction between different types of writing. And then in terms of the spoken language, of course, there are many, many different dialects that are spoken. So if we go back to ancient Egypt, we have a situation where we had a spoken form of Egyptian in the New Kingdom. We had a written form of Egyptian in the New Kingdom in Hieratic, that because it was writing ritual texts and other older aspects of textual culture, was writing a Middle Egyptian kind of grammar, a first phase Egyptian. But we also have written in Hieratic, a form of the language that's late Egyptian, so this second phase Egyptian, that was used in different domains of writing. So not in ritual texts so much, but more in documentary texts and judicial texts and these kinds of things. So that's a lot to get our heads around. And it's really not even as supposedly simple as that in its distinctions. But this is a big change in Egyptian history. Because Egyptian was spoken for so long and was written for so long, the changes are vast. And the changes to the writing system don't necessarily keep up with all of those changes. But at the same time, there was a desire to preserve older forms of the language in a similar way to how there are many forms of the translation of the Bible into English that we still preserve today. For example, the King James Version, whose form of English is very distinct to a modern authorized translation of the Bible. In Egypt, you had, of course, similarly, preservation of ritual and religious texts that were much, much older than the contemporary form of the language. When we get to the late period and the introduction of Demotic, the picture, I'm afraid, becomes even more complex, because Demotic was introduced, as I said, by a center of power that was based in the north of Egypt, and they implemented Demotic throughout Egypt, not to replace all other prior scripts, because they also used hieroglyphs in monumental contexts, in the monumental domain of writing. They also used hieratic when writing ritual texts, for example, and other older forms of textual culture they wanted to preserve in that form. But they introduced Demotic for these essentially secular contexts, so documentary texts and technical texts. Now, what that really meant is that from the late period onwards, you had three scripts that were in concurrent use in Egypt: hieroglyphs in a particular domain, hieratic in particular domains, and Demotic in distinct domains. And as I mentioned, Demotic is not just the name for a script, but also for a form of the Egyptian language, which means that when, from the late period, scribes wrote in Demotic, they wrote a distinct form of grammar that had developed from late Egyptian, but wasn't really the same as late Egyptian. So in broad brushstrokes, in late periods, you had a situation where hieroglyphs as a script, hieratic as a script, Demotic as a script, were used in different domains of writing. And all those scripts more or less had particular forms of Egyptian language that were being written in them, but they really started to mix. And one of my principal research interests that resulted in my doctoral research was this extraordinary mix. Even though Demotic as a script wrote Demotic as a language stage, from its introduction in the late period, that was a starting point after which we still had another essentially 1,100 years of Demotic language. So of course the language changed even more during that time. And the domains in which different scripts were used changed over time. And by the Roman period, so by the turn of the first millennium CE, the first, second, third centuries of the Common Era, we have a situation where Demotic was used in more and more domains of writing, not just to write secular texts like documentary, judicial, technical texts, but also to write ritual texts. They actually start not only with intralingual translation, so translating from earlier stages of the Egyptian language into later stages, so from Middle Egyptian, from Late Egyptian into Demotic. They also start transcribing, so changing the different scripts that these texts are written in from Hieratic into Demotic. And then the picture becomes even more complex than perhaps it was to begin with. So going back to where we started, we have these changes in the spoken Egyptian language that are only traceable in stages as we understand them of the Egyptian language. On top of that, we have an extraordinary temporal frame, a period of time in which these changes occurred. And tracking them, let alone explaining them, is certainly complex. And then we have forms of the scripts that developed, ultimately all from hieroglyphs, but over centuries, into distinct scripts that were not mutually intelligible. So if you learned how to write Demotic, that doesn't mean you'd be able to write Hieratic, which again is an extraordinary consideration, because if we wanted to learn even a neighboring language, for example, French or German or many different European languages, we wouldn't really even need to learn. We'd need to learn perhaps a couple of letters or a couple of accents. We wouldn't need to learn a whole script to learn a different language. Unlike, for example, if we wanted to learn Arabic. But in ancient Egypt, especially in the Ptolemaic and Roman periods, to learn to write all the different forms of Egyptian language and all the different textual culture that was written with those forms of Egyptian language, you needed to know three different scripts from one another. So as you say, the complexity of that picture is very puzzling. And I hope that goes some way, even in spoken form, to explaining these distinctions.
Thank you very much, Ed, for your thorough answers to my questions.
You're very welcome. I hope it wasn't too thorough.
For more information on our Coptic Magical Papyri project, please visit our website on www.coptic-magic.phil, that is P-H-I-L, dot uni, U-N-I, dash Würzburg, spelled W-U-E-R-Z-B-U-R-G dot D-E. It should pop up when you Google Coptic Magical Papyri. Thank you very much for listening once again, and see you next time.